On this Christmas edition of Earth Ancients, we bring back Michael Cremo, author of Forbidden Archaeology. And today, we're looking at ancient wars fought on Earth millions of years ago by ETs looking to dominate and destroy the civilizations on the planet. These wars are featured in the Vedic texts that are not really well known to us, but are translated by Michael and featured in his book, Human De-Evolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. We're not going to just talk about the war. We're talking about the instruments of destruction, the weapons, the various flying craft. And this didn't happen just one time. This happened multiple times that go back hundreds of millions of years in Earth's historic past. All this in the news with Bruce Fenton on Earth Ancients. Saturday, December 18th, 2021. This is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning.
Jingle them bells and frolic. Oh, by gosh, some stalling. Eggnog, gin, and tonic make Yuletide gay and jolly.
Hey, there you go. What are you going to have? You're going to have a hot toddy, eggnog brandy, scotch and soda. What's your drink you're going to have? That's Big Band Vegas Christmas. So we're almost there. We got about a week left and then the big day. So I'm throwing it at you. I'm getting you in the spirit. If you're not in the spirit, you're going to be in the spirit whether you like it or not. Hey, how you doing? Welcome to Earth Ancients, and I hope you're doing well today. We have the amazing Michael Cremo as our guest today, and we're focusing beyond the great antiquity of humanity, or Homo sapiens sapien as it's known, and moving away from forbidden archaeology and looking at a book he wrote in 2003 called Human De-Evolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. And this is an amazing book. You can still get it on Amazon, but I think they stopped printing it. I think it's about $40, maybe $35-$40. If you're interested in the talk today, I would go on Amazon, look for a secondhand copy. You can get one for about $15 or $16. But the chapter we are focusing on, for the most part, is a monstrous chapter called Apparitions, Angels, and Aliens. And the reason that I focus on this book is because you're going to hear some dates today that are going to blow your mind. And, you know, as always, he thoroughly researches everything he talks about. And the interest I have in the great antiquity and the history of the Earth is based on the yugic cycles of human evolution. And the yugas have been a fascination of mine for, you know, many, many years. And in specifically, in this book I'm writing, the Black Knight Satellite, there is a great war for Earth that we're going to talk about today. And in this war, the Earth humans fight for their survival against an ET race. And the Earth humans are backed by a friendly alien group. And this is all historic. When you hear about the dates, you're going to be, your mind's going to be blown. But, in this war, Krishna, who is defending his city of Dwarka, and Dwarka still exists. He is fighting against an alien invading force that is using weaponry that equals the power and the radiation of a sun. And if you hear closely how he describes this war, the devastation that these weapons create is just unparalleled. We can't even imagine what a weapon that is equal to the energy of a sun would do. But Michael backs this up, and this is what's so fascinating. He backs it up by talking about a couple of different cities in India that have been destroyed by some form of catastrophe. And it's not a geological catastrophe. The evidence is in the buildings, in the bodies that are found in various states of decomposition. And how they died, what destroyed them, what killed the people, the animals, and destroyed the buildings, whatever it was, it's something that's similar to present-day nuclear weaponry. And I've always been fascinated by the stories and by the reporting of the radiation that is still there. They use it years ago when the technology became available to measure radiation. They had they would use Geiger counters, and there are even to this day, there are certain parts of India that are highly irradiated. No one knows how, no one knows why, but the physical human remains, animal remains, are irradiated with some form of event, some form of technology that is, who knows, you know. He doesn't so much as say that these areas are off limits, but it's kind of known that you don't go there unless you want to be sick. So we're going to talk about weaponry, ancient weaponry. We're going to talk about ancient humans. And the dates, again, are mind-blowing. So always fun to have Michael. Now, one of the things that I'm intrigued in when I'm writing this book, The Black Knight Satellite, is that there's a great deal of speculation that it's an alien ship that's still orbiting our planet, the planet Earth. I'll give you a heads up. I'll give you a little insight into the book. It's a piece of artifact left from the Great War, these great wars that were fought for Earth. And as weird and as outrageous as that sounds, when you read what I have to say, you're going to either love it or say, poo-poo, I don't believe you, Cliff. There's no way that could be. Well, I back it up with quite a lot of data. So as it gets closer to get published, and I've been promising this for about 5 years, I had a lot of detours in and around the writing of this book. I'm still working on it. I mean, I just finished the last edits on this new book, Cannabis and Sexual Ecstasy for Men. And that's a very important book, too. Of course, it's not anything to do with Earth Ancients. A little bit. I mean, I have a chapter or two on the historic use of cannabis, not only as a medicinal substance, but also as a substance for arousal, men and women. And how that's very important. We'll talk about that in a future topic. But my interest in the Black Knight Satellite is based on some of the writings of Michael Cremo and his ability to translate Vedic texts and translate them in such a way that they make sense, because they're verses. And a lot of orthodox scientists believe that it's all a myth. But if you go to India, a lot of the Vedic science, or spiritual sciences as they're known, are taken seriously. And I believe they should be taken seriously, because they chronicle a lost history. And it's funny that we don't hear from more of the people we have on our program about the Vedic the Vedic sciences, or they call them cosmological sciences, from India, because they're a chronicle of history. They're a historic document, or I should say documents, that outline what Earth was like in the previous civilizations. And, you know, obviously, there's more than one. It's a cycle. Birth, death, around and around and around it goes. What is so mind-blowing is that Michael Cremo actually chronicles man, Homo sapiens, as a being that's lived on the Earth for over 100 million years. I'll say that again. Over 100 million years. So, and he's very critical of the whole theory of evolution that's proposed by Darwin, because Darwin's just guessing along the way, which is a big issue. So that's the program today, and I think you're really going to like it. Now, before we move on, I am going to be introducing a new contributor to the program. I'm going to give you his name here in a second. But this addition to Earth Ancients clarifies a great deal about how Orthodox archaeologists, anthropologists, historians chronicle and present our past. And our regular contributor is going to be Dr. Edwin Barnhard. He is from Texas, and he is going to join us next week in a special edition of Earth Ancients. We're going to look at this tunnel that Dr. Sergio Gomez discovered in 2003 and really analyze what he found and what he chose to leave and not document. And I talk a lot about the visit that we made to this underground tunnel. And as amazing as that invitation and subsequent visit was, there were a lot of questions I had. And, you know, I'm not a scientist, but I can observe as good as the next person what is being missed, what is not happening. And I actually, and I talked about this before, I questioned a lot of the, I asked him a lot of questions about what had happened, and I was shocked at what didn't happen. So Dr. Ed is going to be a regular on Earth Ancients. The interactions will be the alternative theories against the orthodoxy. And I got to tell you, he is a breath of fresh air. So we'll introduce him next week, but look forward to that. Next week is a special edition, the Christmas week edition of Earth Ancients. So something to look forward to. Onward with the show today. We're going to have Bruce Fenton presenting some new discoveries that really push back hominins to the millions of years. And then Michael Cremo, our guest today.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
All right, we are checking in with our science editor, that is Bruce Fenton. Bruce is in the UK. And today we are going to Crete. There's been a fabulous new discovery of very, very old hominin-like, Homo sapien-like creatures found on Crete. So let's check in with Bruce. Bruce, how are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Just that slow build up towards Christmas. So, yeah, it's nice having a nice family Excellent. Time.
Perfect, love it. Yeah, we're looking forward to the 25th. So, all right, hey, so they have found human-like footprints in Crete that date to 6 million plus years ago. Where is this, and who made the discovery?
Yeah, this is quite an interesting one. It's again, it's kind of an update to a discovery that happened several years back, because this actually goes back to 2002. And there was a discovery of a series of footprints. In fact, there's 50 footprints approximately in all in what seems to be, you know, either either at least one hominin or a group of hominins that walked across what would have been a beachy kind of area and has now solidified into kind of sandstone. And there was a theory, a controversial theory, that these were potentially ancestors of Homo sapiens. Now, you can imagine that that was sort of controversial in itself. And then the dating came up to be 5.7 million years, which would really push back, push back the dates on the origins of our ancestors, and also potentially change the geographic location, you know, from Africa to Greece. So that would be a massive shift. So there was a lot of pushback. And then new dating has now been done, and they actually feel these are older. So they've gone back to 6.5 million years now. So, you know, that's is really kind of questioning the understanding that we have of the origins of our ancestors of Homo sapiens. So not direct, these are not directly Homo sapiens, but are believed to be a potential ancestor of our species. So controversial, pushing back the dates and changing the location.
Yeah, so these are these beings are walking upright, which is automatically making them on the a hominin or Homo erectus level. But do we have any sense of the creature? Is it like the creature they found in Tanzania, which is Lucy, which is about 2.5? Let's see. Yeah, well, no, it's millions of years ago. There's no way to know if this is Homo sapiens sapien or Neanderthal or any other creature that is not known, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the theories, well, it could be something similar to the Australopithecus afarensis, which is Lucy's type, which was found in Laetoli, Tanzania. But they've also kind of speculated that this could be what they called Graecopithecus Freyberg. And that was, I'm not sure if we talked about it, but that was from a discovery of, I think, a jawbone in on one of the Greek islands a few years back. And that was theorized to be, you know, an ancient hominin in this region. So it's kind of interesting. They've already had a fossil that's found in the region. And that was, again, controversial. And they're saying this could further validate the presence of these Graecopithecus Freyberg. Some people think that that species is rather made up and that that jawbone is from, you know, more of an ape-like creature. Mm-hmm. So again, there's always controversy when you move, especially when you move out of Africa with these really early dates, you know, because of course, you know, we both know the dogma is really strong on recent out of Africa. So if you start moving the location, there's a lot of pushback. I mean, partly because a lot of the finds are in Africa. So, you know, the argument is, well, look, you know, we've got all these bones there, you know, surely that's where hominins originated. But that's kind of just like an educated guess. There's no particular reason why they could not have come from, you know, the Mediterranean region, which again, not far from Africa, and then gone into the continent and evolved further there. So this is kind of arguments. I mean, we're not looking a million miles away, but even just a little bit outside Africa, you hit more controversy. So it's quite interesting. But yeah, it's potentially something similar to the Australopithecus afarensis is a likely candidate, judging by these, what are kind of archaic hominin type foot structure. So it's got, you know, you can kind of see the toes, you can see the ball of the foot, you can see these things that are considered to be quite distinct to hominins. It's not walking on, you know, all fours. And in other primates and stuff, you know, their feet are much more like the hands. So there's quite distinct differences that suggest that this is, you know, genuinely a hominin.
Yeah. Why is there such controversy? I mean, they found hominins in China and Australia that are extremely old. Why is Crete such a problem? Simply because it's not Africa?
Basically, yeah. I mean, there's so much kind of dogmatic thinking around the idea that, you know, we're certain hominins evolved in Africa. We're certain that modern humans and, you know, Homo sapiens evolved there. That, you know, any attempt to kind of change that part of the story gets enormous pushback. You know, I think we've got to consider as well that there's a lot of academics who have built their names, their careers, you know, and their incomes around that story. And I know people think that's maybe unfair, but it is true. I mean, so that tends to provoke a lot of pushback if you start moving the location for any of these kind of fundamental origin narratives.
I got you.
I know that the guy involved in this, Per Alberg, he, you know, an evolutionary biologist from Uppsala, University. You know, he had a lot of pushback on this when it first came out. I remember it being considered very controversial and getting a lot of attacks from other scientists. You know, they were not particularly happy to hear about it from what I could see in the way that they responded to him. I think he was quite sort of shocked by the amount of aggressive attacks he got.
Complete resistance to it. It's fascinating. All right, we're going to post this on the Facebook page. The title is New Research Suggests Human-Like Footprints in Crete Date to 6.05 Million Years Ago. The findings could upend scientists' understanding of human evolution, but the paper has proven controversial. You'll see it under this week's banner. That's Michael Cremo. How appropriate, Bruce. Very appropriate. Because we'll be talking about ancient humans in the program today. All right, any last thoughts on this?
Well, I'll take the leaf out of Graham Hancock's book and say, you know, things just keep getting older, isn't it? So like our ancestors lived, yeah, a bit further back and also perhaps a little bit further away than the dogma tells us, which is, I think, really interesting. But yeah, we'll keep an eye on it, Cliff, because who knows? Maybe those dates will keep going older.
Yeah, I mean, what are they going to do when they find a modern human footprint that's 10 million years old? That's going to put everybody in
panic.
Panic is right. All right. Hey, we're getting close to Christmas week, so we'll see you just before the special day next time.
Yep. Great. Absolutely great. See you.
We're getting back to our month of December, which means that we are talking with those thinkers, the people who think out of the box, people who are research investigators. And this week, we welcome back Michael Cremo, and he is the author of Forbidden Archaeology and Human De-Evolution. And it's always great to talk to Michael because he is continually researching. We'll talk a little bit later towards the end of this program about a book he's writing. He's currently working on, I should say. And it's always great to have him on the program. So, hey, Michael, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing really great. I'm on the road a little bit. You know, I've been in one place for a couple of years because of all the travel restrictions, but now I'm getting out and about a little bit. So I'm in Gainesville, Florida, at a conference on consciousness studies.
Excellent. So you're able to travel. Yeah, you're able to travel within the United States, which is easy. But just before we started, you mentioned that you were not able to make your yearly spiritual trek to India, which I guess that's
correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, I still haven't gotten into international travel, but I have been traveling around the United States.
Yeah.
And we'll be doing some events like later in April. I'm scheduled to be at a conference in Mount Shasta on the Living Truth Summit. So I'm gradually getting out and about.
So the travel within the United States is easing, and you make it sound like there's more and more conferences that are kind of resurrecting themselves and inviting you to come out and speak.
Yeah. Well, a few. Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a huge number, but yeah, there are a few that are holding live events or sometimes hybrid events.
Hey, let's get into some topics here. I want to talk to you a little bit about your focus on your Hindu philosophy, because the work. Well, let's go to the beginning here. You believe in the Yugas, which basically chronicles millions of years of Earth's history. And within those millions of years, it's your belief, and you write about it in Forbidden Archaeology, man, Homo sapiens sapiens, have lived on the Earth, in your estimation, for millions of years.
Yes.
And you have documented what the first thing I want to ask you is, what is the oldest Homo sapiens sapien ever discovered in situ?
Well, you know, there are different categories of reports. You know, I take a historical approach. I look at everything that's been reported in the scientific literature, whether or not it's accepted by mainstream archaeologists today.
Right.
So when I look at it, if we're talking about skeletal evidence, the oldest report that I was able to find in my research in the history of archaeology was a report that was published in the 19th century in a scientific journal called The Geologist. Mm-hmm. And I think it was from maybe 1853. And it told of a human skeleton, an anatomically modern human skeleton that was found 90 feet below the surface of the ground in Macoupin County, Illinois, which is in southern Illinois near St. Louis, Missouri. So according to the report, the skeleton, the layer containing the skeleton, was covered by a thick layer of slate rock extending for, you know, huge distance in all directions. So that kind of rules out the possibility that the skeleton came down from some higher level into that very deep level, mm-hmm. which according to modern geologists is about 300 million years old.
Oh my God.
So that's the oldest case of human, anatomically modern human skeletal remains being reported in a scientific publication that I was able to find.
And if it was 300 million years ago, the excavation team... I'm sorry?
Before the time of the dinosaurs.
Yeah, I mean, it's an insane discovery that I can see immediately the orthodoxy going, forget it. That must be a false reported doc, because the current theory is a couple hundred thousand years for modern Homo sapiens sapiens. So let's talk about the Yugas, which many people think is almost a myth, but in India, the spiritual sciences there believe that the Yuga is a valid way of chronicling ancient history. So what is your belief about the Yuga? Is it actually a functioning system of determining the different ages, or is it just a way on a spiritual level to chronicle flesh and blood humans?
Well, it could be all of the above. In Forbidden Archaeology, I didn't offer any evidence for the cycle of Yugas. Basically, I just concentrated on an idea that's also there in the Vedas, namely that humans have existed for vast periods of time on Earth, going back many millions of years. But in terms of the Yugas, basically we're talking about cycles of time. And we're all accustomed to dealing with cyclical time. There's the day-night cycle, for example. And during the day, we're awake, we're working. For most people, nighttime is a time for rest, sleeping. We're also used to the cycle of seasons of the temperate countries of the world. You know, there's spring, followed by summer, followed by autumn, followed by winter. And the conditions are different in each of those four seasons. We dress differently, we eat different foods, different sports are played. You know, so we're used to that cycle. But according to many ancient people, there are larger cycles of cosmic time that they were aware of. And they were aware that there were different conditions in each of these time cycles, and that different kinds of activity were characteristic of these cycles. In the Vedic cosmology of ancient India, the cycle of ages was called the Yuga system. And there were four yugas, Satya, Treta, Dwapara, and Kali. And according to the Vedic cosmology, in the first yuga, things are very peaceful. There's no division of classes among people. People are living very harmoniously with nature. They are engaged in spiritual practices. They're behaving in a mode of goodness and harmony and peace. Then in the next age, things become a little different. They begin dividing into rural and urban habitation. They develop a class system, but things are still pretty good. In the next age, the different groups begin to conflict with each other. Mm-hmm. There are conflicts between different classes of people from different geographical regions. They start competing with each other, engaging in conflict, but it's still governed by some sort of principles. There's still some order to it. But in the final age, which is called Kali Yuga, the fourth age, things become totally out of control. There's conflict on all levels of human society. It's predicted to be a time of ever-increasing social and environmental disturbance, which is basically what we're seeing happening today.
I was just going to ask you, we are in the Kali Yuga period. I think we're coming to the end of it, I think, aren't we?
Well, there are different schools of thought about that. The school of thought that I follow is, I mean, some people will say, yeah, we're heading into the next golden age very soon. That doesn't seem to be happening, at least to me. I mean, even just these latest events with the weather in the United States, you know, these huge tornadoes ripping across the country, huge hurricane force winds affecting hundreds of locations all over. And the different social disturbances as well. It doesn't seem to be adding up to a golden age.
Yeah.
Sounds more like the Kali Yuga to me. So I think we've got a long way to go.
So do we have a few hundred years to go, or do we have just a few decades to go, is your sense of it?
Well, according to the Vedic cosmological calendar, the Kali Yuga started 5,000 years ago and will continue for another 427,000 years.
Oh, geez, it's great.
Progressively worse. However, there is a period within the Kali Yuga, the beginning of the Kali Yuga, where things will get better for a short period of time, about 10,000 years. And we're just in the beginning of that uptick.
Thank God. Thank God. We need something to happen here, I'll tell you.
Where there's an opportunity to kind of get out of, I mean, the ultimate goal in the Vedic system of cosmology is to get out of the time cycles, get out of past, present, future, birth, death, rebirth, get to the level of eternity, and which is beyond all these changes that are influenced by the passage of time and its destructive feature. So there is this 10,000 year opportunity to make a lot of progress and perhaps get out of having to go through the remaining years of decline in the Kali Yuga until a new golden age starts. But that's how I see it. Now, okay. It's very interesting, just from the cultural point of view, that other people besides the people in ancient India had this idea of a cycle of ages. The Romans and Greeks have it. They had the idea of a golden age, a silver age, a bronze age, an iron age. The Native American peoples, they also had the idea of a cycle of four ages. And many of the tribes and Native American tribes and the Western United States have this concept of four progressive ages, one becoming worse than the next, than the previous one, excuse me, worse than the previous one. And they symbolize that as a white buffalo with four legs, and with each passing age, the buffalo loses one leg. So according to that idea, we're now in the final age, the fourth age, and the buffalo is just standing on one leg. Geez. The other three legs haven't been removed. It's wow. Kind of interesting that in the Indian cosmology, they have the same symbolic reference of not a buffalo, but a bull standing on four legs, with each one being removed after the passing of one of these four ages. So that's wow. Kind of interesting. You've got these cross-cultural references, like the Mayan people, they have an idea of vast cycles of time passing as well.
Would you say that your devotion, I should tell people that are listening that Michael takes a trip to India every year. He is part of an ashram and he is a devotee to a specific type of it's not really a religion, but my interest in this work that you do is that you believe in reincarnation. And I'm curious to know the writing of this Forbidden Archaeology. Was it based on your spiritual teachings, knowing that you had been reincarnated so many times on the planet that you said, I have to clarify this and make it not just a spiritual knowledge, but an actual factual knowledge in researching this great history that you feature in Forbidden Archaeology? Would you say that was the impetus to write the book?
Yeah, there is a connection. Actually, the spiritual path I follow is called Bhakti Yoga. It's a kind of yoga and meditation. And Bhakti means devotion. Devotion ultimately to the supreme conscious being, you can call God in other words. So one of the principles of bhakti yoga is that you should take whatever ability and talent that you have and use it for a higher purpose, a spiritual purpose, to give people knowledge that will be very helpful to them in understanding their identity and their purpose in life. So the writing of the book, Forbidden Archaeology, was part of my practice of yoga. It was, because I could have used the same abilities to write something else. I could have been writing press releases for the CIA, or I could have, there's so many things you can do with the ability to write and speak. So, but I chose to employ those abilities in this way. So yes, it's part of my practice of yoga, part of my practice of meditation, and it's also connected with reincarnation.
Well, that's, let me just interrupt you really quickly. Are you in touch with any of your past lives that are so significant that they are influencing you today, or obviously in the writing of these books, with specific data, or is it more of the just the feel of being able to connect with those lives?
Well, I don't have any recollection of, say, I was an Egyptian priest in the town of Thebes, and I did this, this, and that. I do have a sense, however, that writing is something that I didn't just do in this life. It must have been something I done in previous lives. Because otherwise, I mean, sometimes we see a child, who's not studied music at all. They may be only a few years old, but they're able to play very elaborate tunes on a piano or something like that. You think, this child hasn't studied music, where's it coming from? It's either coming from some inspiration from some higher source that's coming down right now, or maybe it's the result of practice in previous lifetimes. So I tend to look at my writing abilities as something like that. My mother, departed mother now for a few years, but she used to tell me when I was very young, a couple years old, she would give me alphabet soup. Noodles in the shape of A, B, C, D, E, F, G, etc. And she said, I wouldn't eat it. I'd spell out words in the bowl. So I kind of took this as, that's from some past life. So.
Fascinating.
So I do feel that kind of effort. And, connecting, stones and bones with these spiritual ideas is, for some people, quite a stretch. But for me, what it really indicates is, the archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity just means we need new explanations of human origins. And I think those new explanations are going to have a spiritual element to them, at least in terms of consciousness. Because scientists have not been able to explain the origin of consciousness, which is the most important feature of our identity, of our reality as human beings. If I weren't conscious and you weren't conscious and your listeners weren't conscious, we wouldn't be having this exchange, this conversation. So I think ultimately that's what we are. We're not, consciousness isn't produced by chemicals in the brain. It has its own independent existence. And that's who we really are. So that's the basic point I'm trying to get across, and everything that I do in this area. And yes, you're right, it is connected with my practice of yoga and meditation.
Fascinating. I want to talk a little bit about a book that you wrote a while ago, but it's still, I mean, I've been rereading it, which is The Human De-Evolution, that doesn't get as much play as Forbidden Archaeology. But I was reading a section that you coined on aliens in the Vimana. And I know, and I've read a little bit about the Mahabharata, the verses in there that talk about a great war. But one of the things I'm curious about is, one, this war apparently was a battle either for Earth, or it was a battle among civilizations of Earth that was very, very sophisticated. And there's evidence that you show of great destruction on the planet, which is in India. But can you talk a little bit about this great war?
Yes. Well, actually, it was an interplanetary type of war. And it involves reincarnation in this sense. And, you know, we're familiar with the Star Wars movies, which are basically about a cosmic battle between the forces of good and evil, or darkness and light. And the whole Vedic cosmology is based on that concept, that in this world, there are always and have always been two kinds of persons. One is trying to get into domination, control, exploitation of the material resources of the universe in competition with others. And this means trying to establish domination and control over the other groups. And then there's another group that is trying to come to an understanding we're all beings of pure consciousness. We shouldn't be dividing ourselves up into so many competing groups. Let's just satisfy our material needs cooperatively in the most simple, natural, fair, and efficient way possible. And let's put most of our energy into developing the resource of consciousness. So those two basic groups have always been there, not just on this planet, but throughout the entire universe. So you can call them basically the forces of darkness and the forces of light. So they were competing for control of this Earth planet, and the forces of darkness, they caused some of their persons, personalities, people to take birth on Earth in order to, in different families of kings and like that, so that they could control human society. So they were coming from an extraterrestrial place to the Earth and then recruiting, you know, people on Earth for their cause.
Hold the thought. So just one second, Michael. How long ago was this? How what's the estimated time during Earth's history was this battle?
Well, this has been going on for a long time, but the Mahabharata was specifically talking about one of the latest of these events, which took place about 5,000 years ago.
Oh, 5,000 years. So that's fairly recent. I thought it was like 12 or 20,000. Okay.
Well, if you look at the Puranas, you can find accounts of these battles taking place much further back in time than that, going back even millions of years. it's, you know, the Star Wars have been going on for a long time. And
So I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Both sides were incarnating, sending their people to take birth on Earth in different families of royal dynasties. And then they all arranged for this huge battle at a place called Kurukshetra. And you were kind of mentioning the destructive forces that were available to them. They had a weapon called a Brahmastra, which the descriptions of resemble modern nuclear weapons. And for example, it said that when one of these Brahmastras was set off, it would be as if you had a million suns all concentrated in one place. If you can imagine the energy of the sun, or just imagine taking millions of suns, putting them all together in one place, you've got a tremendous amount of energy being released, a huge amount of light and energy being released at a location where a Brahmastra would be set off. And actually, this was known to Dr. Robert Oppenheimer, who was the physicist who developed the atomic bomb for the United States in World War II. And he was, in addition to being a great physicist, he was also a student of the ancient Vedic literature of India.
Wow.
So he was familiar with these accounts as they're expressed in the Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the most prominent sacred texts of ancient India. It also has accounts of these things. So when the first atomic bomb was tested at Alamogordo in New Mexico in 1945, Oppenheimer was in the bunker, and when the bomb was set off, he began reciting Sanskrit verses from the Mahabharata about this, you know, this great shining light, you know, of a million suns all together in one place. And then later he was asked by a reporter, what was it like to be present when the first atomic bomb was set off at Alamogordo? Mm-hmm. And he said, the first in modern times. And I kind of take that as a reference to the fact that weapons resembling the modern nuclear weapons were used in this great war that was fought 5,000 years ago.
There is a place in India that you'll probably know where there is buildings and remains of bodies that appear to be highly radioactive. And the myth about the place is that they were targeted for some form of energy weapon thousands and thousands of years ago, but apparently certain parts of this city and the surrounding areas is very, very radioactive. In fact, it's even almost off limits. What do you say to that?
Well, I've read those reports. They've been circulating for a long time, starting maybe 30 years ago or so. The place is called Mohenjo-Daro, which is a place in the South Asia Indian subcontinent. It's within the borders of Pakistan now, but it was one of the centers of what's called the Indus Valley Civilization. And I read those reports. They said they're not really recent, although they are circulating, you know, on different websites currently, but they're only when I tried to track down some of the scientists mentioned in these newspaper type reports. I haven't been able to do it to actually confirm these things.
Okay.
But that I in principle I have no problem with such things. I actually believe, yes, weapons like this were used. But whether this particular report is accurate or not, I would like to see some further confirmation of it. But
okay.
You know, it's interesting. There's actually a place in the United States, Meteor Crater in northern Arizona, kind of close to the Grand Canyon area. And for when this crater was first discovered, most geologists thought it was volcanic. And some of them in the 1920s and 1930s proposed, well, maybe it's a cosmic impact to the crater, something left by a big meteor or comet or something. And most of the archaeologists, you know, the prominent ones, geologists and archaeologists, they say, no, it's something volcanic. But in the 1960s and 70s, there was a geologist working for NASA named, I forget his first name, but his last name was Shoemaker. And a comet was actually named after him. But he determined, no, this is not a volcanic crater. It's an impact crater. And he kind of noted, you know, in passing, that it's exactly like atomic bomb test craters that are left in Nevada, because in the 60s, they were still testing atomic bombs openly in the United States. So he said it's exactly like the type of crater that's made by an atomic weapon. And this crater is hundreds of thousands of years old. So maybe these things have been going on for a lot longer time than we can imagine now.
You know, I'm curious because you're saying that this last war between ETs and Earth humans was 5,000 years ago. And then you said that this is a cyclic thing that happens over and over again, and because it's so ancient, it's turned into mythology, you know, which is a lot of times mythologies is actual just memories that are passed down generation after generation. You write about one of the warships quite in great detail, which is these Vimanas. What do we know about Vimanas?
Well, Vimana is a Sanskrit word. It refers to flying machines, including spacecraft. And there are elaborate descriptions of them in the Vedic cosmological writings, which are called the Puranas. And for example, in the Bhagavad Purana, there are many descriptions of Vimanas, and some of them are apparently made of more subtle elements than modern science deals with. You know, they're either some kind of spiritual substances or subtle mental or intellectual substances. But some of them are made from ordinary metals, but they have unusual flight characteristics. And they sometimes involve what I would call extraterrestrial technology transfer. Like there's the case that's described in the Bhagavad Purana of a vimana or spacecraft that was given to a king representing the forces of darkness on earth. This king was named Shalva, and he received this vimana from an extraterrestrial being called Maya Danava, who was the engineer for the cosmic forces of darkness. So he provided this vimana to this king on earth, who used it to attack the city of Dwarka, which was the center for the forces of light on earth. And the descriptions of this vimana, which were written down thousands of years ago, are pretty amazing. It said that the vimana flew over the city and began shooting weapons down, including weapons that resemble these force beam weapons that we sometimes hear about. So it's pretty amazing. And then the people who were piloting this vimana, they also had their weapons that they were using. Like the commander of the ship, King Shalva, was throwing weapons at the leader of the forces of goodness and incarnation of God, known as Krishna. Uh-huh. And said Shalva was shooting, a spear at Krishna. But the way this spear is described, it's kind of clear that it's not a stick with a piece of metal point on it. It said it roared across the sky, flaming, you know, like a bolt of lightning or something. In other words, it really resembles some kind of missile. And the text states that it was shot down by Krishna using arrows. But the way these arrows, so-called arrows, are described, it's like, again, they were streaking across the sky, roaring like bolts of lightning. And yeah, you know, it was like a description of an anti-missile basically taking down another one. So then the flight characteristics of this vimana were described. It said that sometimes it would display copies of itself, and they were all moving around so that the defenders on the ground couldn't tell what is the real vimana and what is a false image.
Kind of a holographic reproduction of itself is what it suggests. Yeah.
And it kind of resembles modern military technology, like when they send warheads on, you know, ballistic missiles to attack another country. The real warheads that have the thermonuclear bomb in them, but then there are decoy warheads also to confuse the radar system of the defending country. Or they also use similar technologies with aircraft, you know, high-speed aircraft. They can project false images of themselves to confuse the electronic defenses and detection devices of the opposite party. So and then sometimes it's stated that this object would appear to fly like a butterfly, you know, like, in other words, not normal flight patterns. And this is something that modern UFO researchers observe, and they speak about when, you know, they're talking about unidentified flying objects that they observe, and that they have these unusual flight patterns.
Would you say that that's a great point you just made about current ufology? Would you say that some of these sightings could be an advanced form of Vimana from an ET race visiting us?
I think that possibility has been recognized, can't be ruled out, even by this group that they formed within the Pentagon to study what they call the UAPs, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena.
Yeah.
Of course, then they're hoping to find, you know, they say, hoping to find naturalistic explanations, but they're considering the possibility they may be of some extraterrestrial source. And then there's this Harvard astronomy professor,
Dr. Evie Loeb. We've had him on many times.
Loeb, right.
Yeah, we've had him on the show a few times. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's openly saying that, you know, some comet-like object that came through our solar system was potentially a probe from some extraterrestrial civilization from another solar system. So, you know, these ideas are becoming more prominent in society.
Hmm. In your research, I want to finish up on Vimanas because this is kind of your sweet spot in many ways. But a few years ago, there was a report that the United States Army in Afghanistan found a Vimana in a cave. And the report was that it had some force field around it. And two of the discoverers were killed because they entered the force field and died. But something as fantastic as that isn't going to be, it's going to be reported, but we're never going to see the light of it because that would quickly be covered up. But did you have any data on that discovery, or was it just a modern myth?
I saw the reports, and you know, again, it all depends upon who you're trying to convince, because I have no objection to these things. To me, it's plausible. There could have been some army people who, for whatever reason, went into a cave and found a Vimana or a UFO in there. And to me, I have no reason to say that that's impossible or it didn't happen. However, if I'm trying to convince an open-minded, not a total skeptic who's going to just reject anything you say, whatever it happens to be, but an open-minded person who has some standards isn't just going to believe anything someone tells them because someone said it, but is willing to consider evidence and testimony properly documented, well, then I've got a bit of a problem because we don't have that kind of evidence at the present moment about this particular case. So that's the problem we get into. If I'm talking to other people who are already inclined to accept these things, well, then it's a good thing, good data point.
Okay.
If I'm trying to influence someone who's open-minded and willing to consider it, it's a harder sell, you could say. You would like some third party contribution. The people who were actually involved to identify themselves.
So it's very speculative, is what you're suggesting.
Depending upon who you are trying to influence. And,
right. Right.
And I try to influence people who aren't already committed to these things.
I hear you. I want to move on real quickly because you talk a full chapter on aliens and alien influence on Earth. We have had Chandra Wick Ramsey on our program a couple of times, who formulated the whole panspermia theory. And he believes that the Earth has been continually bombarded by spores that contain DNA, by biological micro-level bits and pieces of asteroid that have data on them. And it's been done. And the belief is, and it's hard to get them to say this, you know, who the civilization is, but what do you feel about panspermia, number one? And the bigger question is, who is the civilization that is seeding planetary life like Earth?
Very good questions. I know Chandra Rikwan saying we've spoken at the same conferences a few times. Actually, one was in India. I met him there. So yes, he has proposed this idea of panspermia. And that is because if you just consider the Earth and the resources here and the amount of time that's been there, the current theories of how life arose on Earth really don't work out. So, you know, however, if you extend things to the whole universe, then maybe it could work out. But this all depends upon what you consider to be life. And my proposal is that you can't get life from chemicals or from inert chemicals. Life only comes from life. And I would say the main symptom of life is consciousness. So ultimately, if there's any individual conscious existence on Earth or anywhere else, its source has to have been a conscious, individual, personal entity. And in that sense, I would say each of us is an individual, eternal, conscious being. And as such, all of us have been seeded here on this earth from some other place, some other dimension of reality, and that the actual, like any type of body, whether it's a human body or a microorganism body or a dinosaur body, a fish body, a bird body, or insect body, it's a vehicle for a conscious self. Just like a car is a vehicle for a person who drives it. You know, the car doesn't produce the person who drives it. The person who drives it has his or her own independent existence and is simply using the car as a vehicle to attain some goal or purpose. So I would say the conscious self is like the seed, and the so-called bodies, whether we're talking about a microorganism or a whale or a butterfly, that is a vehicle for that seed conscious self. So I would say, yeah, we've all been seeded from an extraterrestrial source, into this world of matter, where we have to operate with vehicles made from matter that we call bodies. Just taking it, however, from the physicalist, materialist, scientific point of view, if you're going to have panspermia, then you have to ask, well, where did those chemicals develop? Who developed them? I think I asked Chandrabhagwan about this. Could it be some higher intelligent being that is responsible for creating the seeds of life that rain down on Earth from outer space? And like you say, sometimes it's hard to get a direct answer from people, but I think in my mind, I've got some acknowledgement from him that yes, that's a possibility. But
the thing is, though, when he talked to me, and we talked about it twice on this program, he was very hesitant to say this is a super race, this is the creator race, who, you know, populated planet Earth and is continuing to help their evolution with. We're able to consciously decide if we want this or we don't, these spores that have evolution in them. And, you know, it's our choice.
Yeah, I think he would hesitate, no matter, and not just him, but anyone who's working within or trying to influence in some way the establishment education system or scientific institutions. You more or less have to proceed incrementally like that. And perhaps at some point, you know, enough groundwork will have been laid that you can talk about these other things that are now considered quite out of bounds. And I understand that. If I were working within mainstream archaeology and not as an independent researcher, I would go about things in an entirely different way. You know, I would try to make some progress, incremental progress within that system. But I'm not so constrained because I don't have to depend upon that system for funding and living and having a job.
Exactly. My guest has been Michael Cremo. Wonderful to have you on the program. Before I let you go, give us a little bit of data on this new book you're writing. What is the focus? And I'm not going to pin you down and say when you're publishing it, because right now everything's sluggish and So what's the feature on that? What can we expect?
Well, I'm calling it Extreme Human Antiquity, More Forbidden Archaeology. And basically what it is, it's a collection of cases that have come to my attention since the original Forbidden Archaeology book was published. So that's basically what the book will be about. And of course it will be announced on my webpage when it's finally published, mcremo.com, mcremo.com. So.
Perfect. Excellent. Okay. Hey, really great having you on the program.
It's great being with you again, Cliff.
Always a pleasure to have Michael Cremo on the program. For those of you who are not familiar with this this book we were talking about, Human De-Evolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory, came out in 2003. It's been a while. And I just rediscovered it. He has so many amazing chapters in this book, and it's not as imposing as the Forbidden Archaeology is, which is as big as an encyclopedia. I think it's 800 pages or something. This book is closer to 350 maybe pages. But the chapter I was focusing on was apparitions, angels, and aliens. And like I mentioned earlier, the alien chapter is taken off the Vedic scripts, the Vedic chapters that he has collected. And they're surprisingly detailed in their descriptions of flying ships, of powerful weaponry, which at the time were described as bolts of lightning. But, I mean, a weapon that can wreak havoc equal to 100 suns is a very powerful weapon. And really, I don't want to be around that weapon when it goes off. So, anyhow, he's always great to have on the program. We'll have him back next year when this new book comes out. And we'll look forward to having him on the program again. So, he's one of these guys that I've known for a long time. And when I call him up, I go, "Hey, Michael, let's have you on the program." He's like, "Okay, wherever I am, we'll do it." And I mean, he's been in Europe. He's been all around the Americas when I've talked to him on the phone. And prior to Zoom, we were using Skype, and sometimes the recordings weren't very good. So there you have it. Hey, if you're enjoying Earth Ages, please consider becoming a subscriber. For as little as $5 a month, you can support the work we do here on this podcast. And it's not just Earth Ages. We're talking about Destiny and the team that puts that together. And, you know, the last couple of years have been tough on us. We've lost people, not to death, but to moving on or for personal reasons. And that's been a challenge. And so, again, you know, $5, $10, $15, even $20 a month makes a huge difference. And we have a bunch of gifts for you. I just uploaded Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty, this amazing book that John Burke wrote in 2005 that really provides us with an insight as to how the Maya and these other Mesoamerican cultures channeled telluric energy in the pyramids they built. And it's really, really an eye-opener and a very, very important book. So that's just one of the 20 books that we have available to you. And there's unpublished interviews. And then once a month, we do conversations with me, Cliff, a chance to meet with me live, as well as other people who are interested in the topics we've been talking about or have a question about a program or just generally want to talk about stuff. That's a chance for us to get together. So to become a subscriber, go to Patreon. That's patreon.com/Earth Ancients and register. And it's really simple. $5 a month really, really helps and keeps the lights on. So I want to thank the following people for becoming members in the month of December. I want to thank Martin Thunberg, Dave Bennett, Mike, the amazing Rich Fuller, Sandy Edwards, and Elfie Combine. You guys rock. I want to thank you for your support. Again, to become a subscriber, to support Earth Ancients, go to patreon.com/Earth Ancients. All right, I want to mention I have a special gift for everyone. I am going to be posting an interview I did with Randall Carlson back in 2016. It's called The Great Flood. It's all about the geological evidence of a horrific flood that he actually chronicles. And the focus is on the Americas, North America, and the devastation to the United States and some of the neighboring countries, Canada, obviously Mexico, and our south. And this will be up in a few days. It's a thank you for listening. from all of your friends here at Earth Ancients. So we're coming close. We're getting up to the final hour of Christmas, the 25th. And I want to mention Graham Hancock's interview will be in January. He is flew out. He is doing a production. I won't talk more about it. I'll let him talk about it when we have him on the program. It looks like it's going to be mid-January. He's confirmed. He just had to move it on. He is not in England right now. He is on set, would you believe? So we'll talk more about that in January. So, all right, that's it for this program. I want to thank my guest today, Michael Cremo, and his contributions to the program. As always, the team, Ruth Thomas, Bruce Fenton, and the production team of Mark Foster, and the editors and everybody else. You guys rock. Thank you so very much. All right, take care, be well, and we'll talk to you next week.